Lecture 2, The Early History of Child Study.
Hello. In this second lecture and in the next two lectures, I'm going to cover the early history of child study, particularly in Europe and in America. I think in order to understand the various theories of development that we're going to focus on in this course, you need to understand the historical background and the cultural context in which they developed. This history of development is shown in six phases. And in this lecture, I'm going to talk particularly about phases 1 and 2, and I'll mention these phases in just a minute. Neurologically and physically, children have probably not changed much in thousands of years. They're basically the same. And yet, they obviously grew up in different contexts, in different cultural contexts, in different time eras. And interestingly, our perspective of their nature has changed to the extent that it seems like when people looked at children and tried to describe them or explain how they were describing different species or a different creature from one time period to another time period. So, in fact, the cultural context in which a child grows up and the particular historical period influences particular child-rearing practices. The problems, the issues that a people or a culture face at any given time will influence the practices. And then these child-rearing practices and these problems in turn influence the perspective of human nature that people have. But it's reciprocal. The perspective we have of human nature, how children are, then influence the way we treat them. And this is a reciprocal, cyclical issue. The theories then that emerge come in part because of the historical context, because of the issues and problems of the day. To begin with, I mentioned that I was going to talk about this history of how we developed a sense of children and the interest in child study in Europe and America. But I would like to begin by comparing some different cultures and societies. And this work mainly comes from anthropological and archaeological studies. Anthropologists have studied what they consider the remnants of certain kinds of primitive societies to try to get a feel for how these societies might have functioned. So a lot of people believe that hunter-gatherer societies were the most primitive and the first kinds of societies that developed. In hunter-gatherer societies, people lived mainly in warm climates where food was abundant. They wandered around rather than staying in one place. And they could live pretty easily under these conditions. Now, the Kung Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert of southern Africa are examples of this kind of hunter-gatherer societies. We've studied them to the extent now, I don't know what they're like now, but at one time we studied them when they were really practicing this form of hunter-gatherer society. In these kinds of societies, like among the Kung Bushmen, children are kept close to the parents. They're considered very close to the parents. They have a very carefree life. They have an easy life. And the parents, in turn, are very attached to their children. The children are not given responsibilities. They're nurtured. They're tolerated. Their activities, they're considered to be children and different than adults. And they're carried around. Part of this is brought about because the people live in nuclear families. It doesn't make a lot of economic or survival sense to have large societies or extended families. So nuclear families rule, and the children then are valued and carried. For example, among the Kung Bushmen, babies are usually nursed until they're about 3 or 4 years of age. Compare that now to agrarian societies that most people believe developed later. And people have studied rural Chinese agrarian societies as they existed some time ago. In agrarian societies, when people settled down, they in fact started forming larger extended families and larger societies. They were in one place, and the economic necessities required that they have a large workforce. And in these kinds of societies, the focus was on teaching people to be cooperative, teaching them responsibilities and to be part of the group and to be economic assets to the entire family or society. Children in these societies then were disciplined in a more harsh manner at earlier ages and were given fairly high responsibilities as young as 3 years of age. Children were often doing household chores, gardening, taking care of younger children. And this was a different outlook on children. Maybe it shouldn't surprise us then that children in these agrarian societies were treated more like adults. They were like miniature adults. They certainly were smaller. They didn't have as much experience. But for all intents and purposes, they functioned and thought and behaved like adults. At least that's how people in the society saw them. The third kind of society that developed were technological societies. And in technological societies, there was a switch back to nuclear families again. It didn't make economic sense to have large extended families, so nuclear families ruled with fewer children. At the same time, though, children were not an economic necessity. They were not cogs as part of the workforce or the machinery. In fact, children became, for the first time, financial liabilities. And children were treated differently in technological societies, especially in societies like ours today. They were considered not necessary, but a luxury and a very valued component. So children now were valued for some other reason, because of their potential, because of their inherent worth. And once again, especially now with the longer period of education required, children were not expected to grow up so fast or given so many responsibilities, and they were treated differently than adults were treated. Once again, they were children. In technological societies, no longer was it possible to have children be trained by apprenticeship models. It was different to have somebody trained to be a physician or an air traffic controller or an administrator than it was to have somebody trained to be a farmer or a carpenter. They now needed to go to school. So in technological societies, for the most part, the responsibility for the disciplining and the upbringing and the education of children is given to society and institutions such as schools, and not so much for the parents. Children are a luxury, but they're highly valued in their own right. There's more leisure to take care of them, and the period of childhood extends to take care of the education and take care of this leisure period. In fact, there have been periods in the past when we had no such category called adolescents or teenagers. Kids were children, then they were adults. Adolescents were invented when, in fact, we had a longer period of time before we needed them in the workforce, and they needed more education. I give that as a background, because if you look at the attitude and the practices of child-rearing and how people related to children in any particular period of time, it would depend on what kind of society they came from and the economic conditions. But now let's go back to Europe and America, because this is the history that influenced the big theorists that we're going to talk about in this course. This is where our history came from in terms of child development. And I want to start with a period of time at the pre-industrial and industrial revolution in Europe, a time when there really was a switch from an agrarian society to a technological society, but things were in flux. Things were really a mess as far as children are concerned. I mentioned that I was going to break this history up into phases. Let me give you the six phases that I'm going to cover. The first phase we can call a lack of concern for children. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. The second phase would be considered when a concern, an interest in children began to develop, but children were seen as being born evil and needing redemption. A third phase I have called the pre-empirical philosophy phase. It was influenced by some primary philosophers, mainly John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and the influence they had on changing the pervading view from children being born evil to something else. The fourth phase is one of observational research, when science started and people actually started paying attention to collecting data and information in a systematic way about children. The fifth phase was the grand phase of theoretical science, the phase in which our theorists that we're going to talk about came from and developed their theories to explain development. And the sixth phase that we're in today can be called contemporary diversity. Theories still dominate, but no one theory. the field is so diverse, it's broken up into many, many areas, and we can't say that one theory has taken over. Let me go back now to talk about the first phase. The first phase I called a lack of concern for children. During this pre-industrial and industrial revolution, it seemed to be that there was not much interest, well, there was no interest in child study, but there wasn't much interest in children anyway. There seemed to be a lack of concern. Children were barely tolerated. To a great extent, they were disregarded. Now, did parents love their children and care about them? My guess is, of course, they did. But in many, many ways, it doesn't seem like they did. It had to be that some of them did. But compared to our society today, the number of problems, the way children were treated, was vastly different and would be considered deplorable and depraved by our conditions today. For one thing, there was an extremely high infant mortality rate. Children in much of Europe had only a 1 in 3 or a 1 in 4 chance of surviving to adulthood. So in the first place, most children were not going to make it past 6 years of age. There are also many examples given of the deplorable conditions and the high infant mortality rate. Let me give you a few. Now, you could say, I'm just selecting certain examples. Well, I'm selecting examples from what we have available and what we can use. For example, in Paris in 1750, 33% of all the children who were born that year were left in foundling homes or on doorsteps, and most of them died. So, despite the fact that we already had a high infant mortality rate, in fact, maybe because of this condition, many, many of the children were given out. It seemed to be their form of birth control. In 1780 in Paris, there were 21,000 births. Of those 21,000 births, 700 babies were nursed by their own mothers. And the rest were either given to foundling homes or given out to wet nurses, hired out to people who would take on the job of nursing a lot of children. The conditions were so deplorable, the hygienic conditions, that most of these people, of these kids, died. And in fact, wet nurses then were given the nickname of killing nurses. In Dublin, between the years 1775 and 1800, so in a 25-year period, there were 10,272 births of kids that were left in foundling homes. Over 10,000 kids were placed in foundling homes. Of that number, 45 survived to adulthood. So it was virtually everybody left in a foundling home died. The conditions were so bad at this period of time for many years in Dublin that Jonathan Swift made this comment about it. Now, Jonathan Swift was a satirist, but even his satire here is a little extreme. This was really written, as he said, a modest proposal for preventing the children of poor people from being a burden on their parents and on the country and making them beneficial to the public. And here's what he said. He, by the way, got a jab in at Americans as well. He says, I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well-nursed, is at a year old a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled. And I make no doubt that it will equally serve as a fricassee. So his point was, rather than giving up these children to foundling homes to die, why don't we just eat them? Now, most people, if somebody said that today in our papers, wouldn't find that very funny. But conditions were tough. In England in this same time period, boys and girls were often sent to the mines to work, often as young as 4 and 5 years of age. One reason they were sent so young is because families needed the money. Everybody was poor. And they couldn't take care of all their kids. Their kids would go out and bring in some money. But the kids were also small. And they figured this was good because they could crawl through the little tunnels in the coal mines and the different kinds of mines. They often worked naked because it was so hot. Often would work all day, bend over, not being able to straighten up, working like pack mules, carrying carts with them. There is one case given of how to handle these kids that were in the mines when their eyesight failed. Said, grab them by the ears and bang their heads against the wall to straighten out their eyes. There was another piece of advice to parents on taking care of your children. Don't change their diapers very often. Because if you change their diapers, this is the quote, would draw away the child's nourishing juices like a sponge. There were many, many cases of infants who were left by the fireplaces in the kitchens and caught fire and burned, of children being eaten by dogs and hogs in the barnyard and left to die in strange ways. So we think, well, they had disease. They had more than disease. It seemed to be a lack of concern, a lack of toleration for children, at least to an extent that we don't have today and would be appalled at. What was the cause of this lack of concern? And what effect do you think this had on people's perceptions of children? Well, we can never say completely what brought this about. But one speculation has been that when the chance of survival is extremely low, when the infant mortality rate is extremely high, children may not be as valued. And perhaps the reason is that the emotional investment it takes to get involved in children is too difficult when most of them die and can't make it. There is some evidence that people who have children who have medical problems and must be left in nurseries, even today, have a hard time knowing whether they should get close, whether they should withdraw, whether they should get emotionally attached if they don't know what's going to happen to the baby. They want to, but there is this problem, knowing they won't make it. Now, I haven't been around. You haven't been around to see what it would be like if you knew that most of your children would die and these conditions were like this, but this may have added to it. When children did survive infancy, they were expected to work for the family. Keep in mind, this was a transition to a technological society, and we talked about the difference between agrarian and technological societies. This was a time of transition. Children were not needed as a cog of the workforce in terms of being on the farm. They were becoming a liability unless they were sent out to work. This whole process of not being tolerated and then being sent out to work may have then reinforced the perception that people seem to have of children, that they were like miniature adults. Again, they were smaller, they were less experienced, but they were not considered different cognitively, in the way they had developed from just being little adults. To give you an example, if you look at a baby lizard is like a miniature adult lizard. You don't really see much difference except in size. Well, think of children being like that. You can see this sometimes if you look at the way children were depicted in the art of the times. Now, the art of the times would be paintings were done by wealthier families, the nobility or the wealthy people. But even in these cases where children were treated better, they weren't sent out to the mine, for example, you still see children depicted smaller, but looking somewhat like adults, not looking like babies. And in fact, in some of the wealthiest of the society, in the nobility and in the courts of Europe, and particularly in France at the time, children were included in all the adult activities. They weren't excluded. They didn't have an R rating as we do today to protect children. If they had a wild, ribald party, the children were there. Anything that happened, they were exposed to. And in fact, there are cases given of children who were invited into parties that were really wild orgies and made to do really wild orgy-related sexual stuff for the amusement and entertainment of the adults that were there. There wasn't a sense that children needed protecting or needed to be treated in some way differently than the adults were treated. So this was a sad state of affairs. And you can think, it had to change. Times were ripe for a change. And I'd like to now talk about a second phase in this history of child study, and I think this was the change that came about. This was a growing concern for children. But in fact, this growing concern for children seemed to be a concern for children that was led mainly by religious leaders and a view that children were born evil and needed redemption. There were also physicians and some other enlightened people that helped to bring about this change. Let me give you one example. William Cadogan, in 1777, was a physician in England who published a book for parents on parenting. I guess you could say he was the Dr. Spock of his time. It was a book, and I've read some parts of it, and he had profound advice for parents. He said things like, change their diapers, give them fresh air, don't beat them up, give them nutritious food. Profound things to help parents to know how to be a better parent. In the late 1700s and the early 1800s, though, a movement emerged that became known by many as the Sunday School movement. It was because of the pervading Christian religious beliefs that children were seen as being born evil, mainly because of original sin. And because of the way this was their nature and the way they were seen as being damned unless this evil was purged from them, unless they could some way be redeemed and changed. The idea was that, in fact, self-will had led Adam and Eve to go astray. Self-will was a bad thing. We had to bring these children under the subjugation of a more moral code, living for higher standards and not being the way they naturally were. But it did lead to education. Let me give you another quote from John Wesley, a famous and very influential religious leader of the time. He said, and he's talking about how we should treat children, break their wills betimes. Begin this work before they can run alone, before they can speak plain, perhaps before they can speak at all. Whatever pains it costs, break the will if you would not damn the child. Let a child from a year old be taught to fear the rod and cry softly. From that age, make him to do as he is bid. If you whip him 10 times running to effect it, if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. You can see where that came from. If you do not conquer, you ruin him. Break his will now, and his soul shall live, and he will probably bless you to all eternity. And at another time he said, this is John Wesley again, talking about children, they are more foolish and more wicked than they can possibly conceive. The desire of the eyes must not be fed by pretty playthings, glittering toys, red shoes, necklaces, or ruffles. So you can get a feel for the view that was around. Now, this sounds pretty tough. In fact, you may remember a little bit later, but Charles Dickens writing stories about the schooling and the education that was sort of the result of this movement. It was harsh. The discipline was tough. It seems nasty. For us today, it seems that way. But think of it relative to the way things were before the Sunday School movement hit. It was still, nevertheless, an improvement over the previous deplorable conditions. Because mainly, kids were now of concern. The people had to do something for them, and they were getting an education, getting some kind of training. In addition, there was an increasing middle class. And with this increasing middle class, there was a lower mortality rate, there was more leisure time, and therefore more schooling was possible. For the first time, they had the luxury, if you will, of paying attention to the concerns of children. In this same time period, though, in America, things were more optimistic. When America began, people came here, the colonists first came here, and they thought of this place as a future utopia. In fact, they called it the New Jerusalem. And in calling it the New Jerusalem, they saw children as the hope of the future. Children could make something of themselves. They had potential. This is the way that they would achieve some form of utopia that was not possible before. And because of this, they paid a lot of attention to education and to children. The educational reforms, pediatric medicine were stronger here, developed faster than they did in Europe for these reasons. However, even in America, they still had the view, the pervading view, that children were born evil in original sin, that morality was important in training, and this is what needed to be done. There are examples in the United States, or in early America, I should say, when Parents thought they were getting too close to their children. They just were too attached to them. They loved them so much, and they were worried about what negative effect this would have on the outcome for their children. So they would arrange to trade children with neighbors. And in trading children, they were then left to be able to be harsher and stricter in their discipline and could expect this for their children as well. So this is an interesting change. We've gone now from no interest in children and certainly no interest in child study, no systematic study or putting together of a theory of child development, to an interest, a concern in children, but children viewed as being born evil. Their basic human nature is evil, and they need to be redeemed. What would come next? What would be the next step? Well, in fact, we're going to talk about that later in terms of the next step. Children were then seen later as, what would you expect, going from being born evil to maybe being born neutral and not being evil. And the step after that was children going from being born neutral to being born good, having many positive, good qualities. And these are the effects that came about by philosophers and people who then built on what had already been to change the view of children even further. The main philosophers that had this influence on children were two: John Locke in England and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Switzerland. These two philosophers overlapped in their time period of the period we've already talked about, but this movement was already mounting and starting. John Locke in England rebelled against the pervading view of children being preformed in some way and took on a view that, in fact, they came into the world neutral and without any kind of preformation, whether it be evil or good. He had the view that children were born neutral. He coined the phrase, children are born as a tabula rasa, a blank slate, upon which the environment writes and creates the person. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, on the other hand, went further to say that children are born with tendencies to be good and perfect, and left to their own devices, will develop into very good, accomplished, optimal people. And it's only society that then corrupts them when society gets in the way. And in our next lecture, we're going to talk more about the work of John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, these philosophers that changed the view. And we're going to talk about how their work is related to two major approaches or worldviews about human nature and child study. One is the mechanistic view, and one is the organismic view. Thank you.